everybody. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti and the Positive Mind, WBAI, 99.5 FM on your dial. You there, Roberta?
I'm here.
We're bringing you something interesting today. Today we're bringing you an idea, something to that you're going to learn about. It's just going to get you. Yep, women and meat. M-E-A-T. Today we are going to talk about how women's sexuality shaped evolution. This is going to be such an incredible bunch of information. It goes back to a bottleneck in evolution that is hard to believe. So we're going to go back. We're going to take you back, my friends, 150,000 years. 150,000 years, we're going back, 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 back. Animals are there. Everything is cool. Let's talk about the mating procedures of animals 150,000 years ago. How did it work, Roberta? Before humans came on the scene, animals, it was kind of easy, right? Animal wants to have sex.
Well, first of all, humans were part of the category as well, if you mean that animals had a certain way, certain rhythms of mating. Humans, up until recently, participated in those rhythms, and then about 150,000 years ago, they took off in a different direction. And that is because humanity got to a point where things almost came to a disaster. The mating rhythms were such whereby males and females of the higher species, the mammals, the primates, would the fertility of the female would happen at a certain time, and at that time she would give signals either through scent or body language or sight, feathers, fur, something would show to the male that she was in estrus, meaning that at that time her body was ready to conceive. Only then would the male be interested in her.
Now, this is in the animal kingdom, higher animals, mammals, right?
Mammals, yes.
In all mammals, there is a sexuality that takes place when males are responsive to females when they are in estrus. That means the female sends off a signal, says, I'm ready for sex. And the male says, okay, I sniff it out. There it is. There's a ready female. I want to have sex now.
But you see,
don't animals always want to have sex?
No, Armand. In fact, this is not something that animals engage in with the intent to procreate, for instance. They have no idea that out of the mating behavior, they're going to get an offspring. So this is just a simple instinctive behavior, the same thing as eating or sleeping or drinking. So when one is hungry, one looks for food, finds it, and eats it. It's dictated by the brain's limbic system, by the basic survival system in the nervous system in the brain. There's nothing that requires any thinking.
So wait a minute. If a woman goes out with a guy, or a guy goes out with a guy, and the guy is extra horny, right, and the woman says, you animal, she's really being inaccurate. Because if the guy is not picking up on signals that are saying, I want you, the guy's not really being an animal. Or do animals sometimes exhibit mating behavior even though they're not responding to mating signals?
Well, yes, they do, Armand, but that's only to
establish...
Because
a dog will hump your leg.
That's only to establish dominance over another member of the pack or the group or over one's companion. So the humping behavior that you're talking about, the behavior that looks, that has certain movements that remind you of mating behavior, happen as a way to establish hierarchy, which in the end is also a survival strategy whereby a group of animals, by determining who's in charge, who is the leader, who decides when to leave and when to stay and when to fight and when to flee, by establishing a hierarchy, a group of animals enhances survival of the individual. So you'll see humping when a member, usually a dominant member of a group of animals, wants to express, let's say, wants to communicate a certain message to another member, but that has nothing to do with mating.
Wait, I got it. Roberta, we're going to talk about how women sexuality affected the entire turn of mankind, but I don't think any radio program ever has talked about a dog on a man's leg. And since we are in the mental health profession, we have a right to talk about it.
Absolutely. If not us, who would?
Who else? Right. Okay, a dog jumps on your leg. He's dominating you?
No. In that case, it's an expression of affection.
Affection.
Or it's simply, believe it or not, it is simply a physical going through the motion. Sometimes domesticated animals will go through the motion of moving the body in a certain way that resembles mating behavior simply because the body has a certain need to express companionship or to express something other than a mating interest. Because in reality, you know, I'm not sure that dogs are really expressing a desire to mate with their masters or their owners when they do that.
But they just pick any old leg.
Yes, so in that case, the body's just expressing, it's just going through the motion.
But what are they responding to? Where's the estrus? Where is the sexuality that they're responding to? Because they're fully aroused and they're going through this thing.
You mean when a dog does that to a man?
To a man or a woman,
well,
yeah.
When you look at that behavior on the part of a domesticated animal, Armand, you always have to look at the fact that domesticated animals, tame animals, animals that live with humans, their behaviors are not standard.
Okay,
they've already deviated from standard behavior. In a pack of wolves, if you see a wolf getting on top of another member of the group, it's usually a sign of dominance over that member of the group, or is a display of dominance for the group to see.
I understand. So if I run into a wolf in the forest, I'd rather he jumps on my leg.
I think that would be your better option, yes.
My better option.
Rather than to try then to do that to him.
Right. Anyway, let's go back to this. Here we are, 150,000 years ago, humans are trying this mating game. Trying. And now remember what the norm is. The norm is the way the thing is built. The female of the species goes into estrus. Means she says, I'm ready. She puts out these female signals. The male then gets these signals and he gets aroused and goes into a mating behavior followed by a mating process. And that's the way it is.
Right. And it does not include the awareness that an offspring is going to come out of this.
Right. All he knows is it's going to be fun. This is good. It's mandatory. Now I got to jump on this person and I'm going to have a good time.
No, this person. We're talking about an animal.
This animal. I'm going to jump on this animal and I'm going to have this thing happen. And it's going to be nice and it's going to be pleasant because there's pleasure built into it.
But Armand, there's none of that thinking. It's just as if you have a hungry dog, put a piece of meat in front of the dog. The dog doesn't think about anything. The dog just eats the meat. It's the same thing.
It's not pleasurable.
It might very well be, just like eating when you're hungry is pleasurable. But that's not why that's not why an animal will engage
it's
in eating.
It's not like pleasurable, like a human would think of, oh boy, I'd rather have sex than eat pizza.
But the thing is, it's not dictated by the desire for pleasure. It's dictated by hormonally driven physical behaviors. So the behavior will happen even if that animal is out of his mind, even if the animal is not aware of where he is. I mean, the hormones will take over the body.
If a dog were tempted with the smell of an estrusian female or a rare steak, which might the dog choose?
It depends if the female is fertile. Oh, you mean if the female is in the time where she's fertile? Most likely he would choose the female over
even
the
if
meat.
He were hungry.
Absolutely.
Right, because this is the drive.
You always think in terms of survival of the species. It is more important for the species to choose mating when it's the right moment than eating.
This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. We're going to be getting to some very important, interesting stuff here, my friends. bear with us. It gets very exciting.
So the point we're making up until now is that mating
behavior... Up until 150,000 years ago.
Right. Mating behavior in humans as well as animals does not involve thinking about having a baby. And it's simply dictated by hormonally determined changes in the body's function and behavior.
And it doesn't really involve getting laid.
No.
You know what I mean? It's not the idea. It's not the idea of I'm going to have sex for the pleasure of sex.
No.
It doesn't have a thinking idea.
No, it's the same thing as when an animal feels like sleeping, it falls asleep.
It's I'm going to have food, I'm going to have sex, I'm going
to
have...
It's very simple. Hormones say to the female, it's time, the egg is ready to come down from the ovary into the uterus to be fertilized. So the female shows signs that that's the case through very often scent. The male nearby picks up the scent, and in the brain of the male, testosterone now goes to work. And the brain of the male says, she's ready. I better do it right now before she leaves or before another male shows up. Now is the time. They go, they do it, that's it. They have no intention of having a baby.
But he enjoys it.
Of course. If it weren't not rewarding, they wouldn't engage in it enough to ensure the continuation of the species.
Does she enjoy it?
Apparently.
No, I mean, does she have as much pleasure as he does?
It's hard to say because when you observe animals, you project your own, knowledge of what you're watching or what you're looking for onto the animal that you're observing. You cannot ask the animal, but apparently, judging from how she behaves, she wants it as much as he does. That's for sure. And she enjoys it as much as he does. So in animals, you don't have this thing like you have in humans where it seems like the male wants sex more than the female.
Right. There are certain female monkeys I know who will have sex with hundreds of male monkeys. And there are certain male monkeys who will have sex with hundreds of female monkeys.
Exactly. In the animal world, the female, when she's in estrus, when she's fertile, not at any other time, but when she's fertile, she wants to engage in mating as much as the male does. But also, the male is not interested in the female unless she is in estrus, whereas in humans... Men seem to be interested in having sex all the time.
Well, we're going to get to how that happened.
Right. I wanted to point out the difference that it's not just that the female is as interested in sex as the male is with animals. The difference is also that the male is only interested when she's interested.
Well, this brings us to a certain point and the point of the program today that I think is very valuable. Our bottom line is going to be that women are not as interested in sex as much as men are. And this is going to be what the bottom line is, and we're going to make a fairly scientific presentation of why this is.
But Armand...
We're going to back our way into it. Let's not get to the punchline yet.
No. I'm not getting there. But what I'm saying is, it's not that the female is not as interested, is that the female has so much at stake in the reproductive game, and the male has very little at stake compared to the female. So the female, in order, again, for survival of the species, has to be so cautious.
We got to go back 150,000 years.
Let's do it.
150,000 years, called an evolutionary bottleneck.
Yeah. This right? is all, by the way, according to the research done by the author of Sex, Time, and Power.
Dr. Leonard Schlong.
Leonard Schlein.
Schlein.
Schlein. He is, I believe, a brain surgeon who wrote a wonderful book that Armand and I did a show on called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, one of the best books I've ever read. And we talked about several times that book. So now he came out with this new book. So everything we're talking about today, I have read in this book, and I find it fascinating. And, of course, Dr. Schlein, his research is impeccable.
150,000 years ago, there we have this situation. Humans are on four legs, right? And they're trying to get by, or they're barely on four
they're
legs.
They're not on four legs. They're like chimps. They use all fours to go up the trees.
They can't really outsmart the better predators. They need a bigger brain.
The way they outsmart them is they climb up the trees.
Right. But in order to do the rest of it, they got to get smarter.
Well, what happens is that at some point, the primates that became the hominids evolutionarily gained an advantage by standing upright. Why was that an advantage, Armand? Because now they could hold things with their arms, right? If you're running on four legs, you can only hold food in your mouth. And there's only so much food you can carry in your mouth at any given time. But if you can hold food in your arms, you can carry a lot more food, which means if you make it safely back to your cave or to your tree dwelling or wherever it is that you live, you have enough food to live for a while and you don't have to go out again and look for it. So this is a great advantage. But it presents a disadvantage because when you stand up on two legs, you can't run very fast, not compared to a predator that runs on four legs. So the disadvantage is that you're a lot slower. How did humans compensate for this disadvantage that was the consequence of becoming bipede in Italian, mm-hmm. on 2 feet instead of four? The disadvantage was that now they could not run. How did they compensate for that? They became smarter. They became able to outwit their four-legged predators, like the lions, the tigers, and the bears. So now we have a primate, a hominid, that stands up on 2 feet, is able to carry a lot of food in its arms, cannot run very fast, but is smart enough that it can figure out ways to escape the predators.
And hide its food if necessary. And throw up little camouflages and maybe throw a little food at the predators. Figure it out, you know.
So now this
throw a stick, you know,
primate that has become very smart in order to survive its own evolution has a brain that is bigger compared to body size than that of any other animal in history. So now we have a female of the species that has to give birth to a fetus, to a baby, with a huge head.
All right, now this is what's happening. 150,000 years ago, babies, humans, get smart to survive. The ones that aren't so smart, they got smaller brains. Smaller brains mean smaller heads. They're born fairly easily, but, you know, they just don't make it. The body says, the human species says, survival says, we got to get a bigger brain. So now these big heads start being born. Remember, we're talking about a bottleneck here. We're talking about what happens to the human race, which almost cost us our survival. We almost disappeared 150,000 years ago. There was almost no more humans.
That's right.
What happened?
Because now imagine this hominid, a primate, that is able to stand up and walk around on 2 feet, carrying a lot of food, and now it has to give birth to a young with a huge head. And so the body of the female accommodates by widening the hips, widening the hip bone structure so that she can accommodate a larger and larger head. But it can only accommodate so much because if you're standing up and you don't have enough bone structure to support the bottom of your trunk, your intestines will fall out.
So in other words, if you're going to have a baby with a bigger head, you've got to open your pelvis in order for the baby to be born. But if you open your pelvis too much, your intestines fall out.
So and everything else with it, the liver, I mean, all the organs that are held up.
So the first thing that happens is the head gets bigger, but the pelvis stays smaller. And for a little period of time there, maybe 10,000 years.
We don't know exactly for how long.
I think it was 4,217 years.
Yes, you have it right.
Their babies have bigger heads
than the mother can
accommodate. Than the mother's pelvis, and bodies are being found,
yes,
of hominids, mm-hmm, who are dead
women, young women,
who are dead with babies giving birth because they have no way of giving birth.
Right. The head of the baby gets stuck in the pelvis.
Inside.
And there's nothing to do because it's just too big for it to come out.
And they couldn't do cesareans
because... Back then they couldn't do cesareans.
Because Caesar wasn't born yet.
Exactly. They didn't have a way to call it, so they couldn't do it.
Right.
And so we have a lot of young female and their babies that die as a result of this evolution. So there's a demand now put on this new species to figure out a way out of this bottleneck.
Okay, so let's just get back and make sure you get this, friends. So human race is being faced with its extinction because bigger heads can't pass through the canal.
Right.
Mother dies. Mother dies. Mother dies. Nobody knows at this time why mother is dying. Nobody even knows that sex makes babies. Keep
right.
this in mind. There is no, these are animals that are pretty smart, but people don't put together yet that sex makes babies.
No, they didn't know that.
They didn't know that. They just knew that sex was one thing they had, like eating. And then they knew that this thing happened, which is pregnancy. And then they knew that somebody died.
But they did know that when a woman was about to give birth, it was a life and death event. It was very dangerous and many women died. Possibly more than 50% at some point.
Dying,
yes. Because the brains were too big and the baby's head couldn't make it through.
So what's a species going to do?
And the point that Dr. Schlein makes in the book is really fantastic. In terms of how he arrived at this, but I really encourage you to get the book and read it. But the point that he makes is the female was the one who was faced with dying, right? So really the pressure was on her, the pressure to figure out a solution for the problem. So she's the one who actually found the solution. Of course, not she herself, but Mother Nature or Father Nature came up with this. The solution is because the female was put in the position of putting so much risk, so much at stake, her life at stake, and the survival of the species at stake because of birth, she was able to make the connection somehow, one of those revelations, between mating and giving birth.
And eventually that would have to come up as a relationship.
But
them that mated wind up dying. Them that didn't mate
exactly
didn't wind up dying and right. having this pregnancy thing. Therefore, mating and death went together.
She probably became more observant than the male.
It was like being Catholic, you know. If you have sex, you're going to die.
I guess maybe that was the forerunners of the. The Catholic faith. So, Armand, we shouldn't say these things. So, the female somehow is given a revelation by nature. Aha! If I have this romantic encounter, I may die 9 months from now. So, for the first time ever in the history of evolution, an animal became capable of overriding her own sexual urges, her own hormonally dictated instinctual behavior, and became able to say no. I am not going to mate with you tonight.
She had a pretty strong reason. I mean, you know,
yeah.
death was the aversion technique.
She figured out if she's going to put that much at stake, she better be careful who she mates with.
You know, and there was enough oral tradition there going along among the families, you know, grandma and ma and people talking, saying, you know, this is mating equals death. At this particular time, 150,000 years ago, until you guys could do something about it, you know, you with the little pelvises and your babies with the big heads, you better be careful because...
The thing is, she became able to deny not just his desire for sex...
But her own.
But her own, which is unthinkable up until that point because no animal had ever been able, through thinking, to override hormonal dictates, which are imperatives. Because up until that point, evolution had successfully happened thanks to hormones. Everything that had happened that was successful had been an adaptation that had come about through endocrine system functioning better and better. So now we get to a point where the endocrine system has to be told, no, I'm going to override your orders, and I'm going to take control of the situation, and I'm going to say, no, I'm not going to have sex tonight.
Imagine this. Imagine a world, my friends, where there was no bottleneck of small pelvis and big head. You know, and instead the society developed, and we, like every other species, just, you know, whenever we felt like having sex, female would send out a signal. Male would then only want to have sex when female sent out the signal, and that's the way our society developed. It would be a very interesting society.
Well, it wouldn't be a society in which there would be no sex in exchange for anything.
No.
It would just be equally desired by both genders, and it would be enjoyed when the time is right for both.
And not necessarily enjoyed. It would be
well,
done.
It seems like sex is enjoyable regardless. But okay, it doesn't happen for humans. It's enjoyable all the time.
So a thing happened 150,000 years ago where women for the first time not only did but had to develop the ability to say no. They had to say, I don't want to die. It looks like death. I think I'll curtail this. I think I have to be a little more selective. I think I'm going to have to figure out how I'm going to get through this. But I'm not going on no hormonal automatic anymore. Even if there is an imperative in my genes, I'm going to go put on different genes.
For instance, she might decide that she was not old enough. But see, that requires a tremendous capacity to think, and it requires the ability to abstract, to think in abstract, which, I mean, no animal can do that we know of. Thinking in abstract meaning that one is able to make a mental connection with an event or with a person or with an image that's not there, that's not immediate. And that's something that only humans can do that we know of according to what we observe them to be able to do. And the first to do it were the females. They were able to make the connection between sex and childbirth.
The first form of thinking may have been, the very first form of thinking may have been thinking how to turn a man down. Sorry to say. That if guys have to suffer with this, and you've had to suffer with this your whole life, you know, it may have been the basis of mankind. The evolution, the saving of the human race may have come from this form of thinking. Einstein, right, may have only developed from the very act of someone saying, we need a brain that could figure things out, and one of the ways it's going to figure things out is through abstract thinking. And part of what abstract thinking is the ability to figure out, well, I can't have sex now. When can I have sex? And I have to develop a brain that's going to tell me when I can encourage a man to have sex. So this is what happened 150,000 years ago, my friends, and we have just started with you. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. We're talking about how women's sexuality shaped human evolution. The consequences of which are amazing. We'll be back with you in just a little bit. If you can't stay with us, you can get a copy of today's program by calling 212-757-4488. We'll be back with you shortly with more on women's sexuality.
This is Lawrence Block, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener supported and non-commercial.
Okay, Armand, come on in.
Me, it must be me. Dear God, oh, how can I survive? Will I make this drop, this dive, when it all comes to this? Looking down at the abyss where you don't exist, you don't exist.
Onyx, Dear God, the Prayer. It's Armand DeMille here. That was Annie Lennox. Prayer. Oh, God. Hey, listen, friends, this is it. So that's exactly what happened. There comes that woman look at it and they say, oh, God, what are we going to do now? Sex equals death. What are we going to do? Well, let's think about it. And that very act of let's think about it becomes fairly important, Roberta. So they figure it out. What do they do? So they say, let's wait till we're older.
Well, they figure out a way in which they can be more in control of who they mate with, when they mate, maybe how old they are, maybe how healthy they are, maybe how much support they have in terms of sisters and aunts and grandmothers. I don't know what the factors were that gave a woman a sense of security that, yes, she could now say yes and go ahead and have this baby. Perhaps the most important thing was in the choice of the mate. And now we come to how women's sexuality did shape human evolution. Now, let's remember that up until this point, the animals did not know the connection between mating and having babies. But now the human female does. So what else does she do? Well, first thing she does is she becomes able to say no and override her own hormonal drives. And then the second thing that she does is she hides her estrus. For the first time in history of evolution, an animal, female, would not, whenever she was fertile, that would not be visible to the male, nor to herself. I mean, she may have a sense, but there was no certainty like in other animals.
Now, a woman is fertile about 2 weeks after her period?
Approximately.
Somewhere in middle schmerz, right? It's around the middle of the period date?
The middle of the lunar cycle, because the other thing that happened is cycles became attuned to the moon. Isn't that incredible? The fluids on Earth, the water on Earth, the oceans, of course, we know that the tides will come and go according to lunar cycles, but so does the woman's menstruation. So the other thing that is completely puzzling is how the cycle of the woman is strictly dependent on the moon cycles, but neither her mate nor she know when exactly she's fertile. So that now what's happening...
Oh, wait, go back a second, Roberta, because I know it may make sense to you and it may make sense to women, but she hides her estrus.
She does.
To herself.
To everyone.
Estrus being that time of month when you get these smells and these parts of your body that say, I'm ready. I'm ready. I'm fertile. I'm ready to have sex and make babies.
If you have a cat, Armand, a female, that's not altered, you know when she's, we say, when she's in heat, when she's in estrus, because she behaves very differently from when she isn't. She doesn't seem to be interested in eating. She meows a lot. She looks for a male. She eagerly calls the male.
She sprays.
She does all kinds of things that she does not normally do. But that only will last for that time when she's fertile. And then it will, that behavior will disappear and never show up again until the next time she's fertile. But in women, this does not happen. Women don't send out a signal that they're ready. Women are always ready.
So what women became is they became always ready, but they hid their real ready time.
Correct. So the male does not know.
So that the male would not know that they were in estrus, so they would not turn the male on. Now, wait a minute. What sense does that make?
Well, what the sense it makes is that if the male does not know that she's in estrus, first of all, it heightens the competition between males because any female could be fertile at any time, all right? So any male that comes by could impregnate her. But what sense does it make is that it makes him always ready to mate, which means it is no longer up to him when a baby is conceived. He's always ready. Always thinks that the woman could be ready. So the human male is the only male organism that is so interested in sex all the time with any female without ever having any time down. And the reason for that is it enhances survival of the species, because if a woman is ready and if she's fertile and if the males around her are always ready all the time, those are the best odds for her to conceive.
So a normal male, normal meaning according to the evolution of our species and according to the way that the women have responded, if a male is normal, he's ready to have sex any minute, any time with anybody.
That's right. And the height of this is right after puberty for males, because that's when the testosterone levels are highest, or at any time in life when his testosterone levels are at the highest. That's when the males are the most ready, because that's when they're the most potent physically. But a human male is the only one in all the animals who is interested in any female, anytime, anywhere. There's no other male that has that much sexuality other than the male. And that's caused directly by the fact that the female hides her estrus. So she could be fertile anytime.
So because women hid their estrus, because they hide their readiness, they therefore leave the man guessing. Therefore, it left men constantly ready. So now we got a society of horny men.
Right.
But according to our society, men who are always horny are looked down on.
But you see, that's a cultural thing, which is actually came about, supposedly, most likely, because the fact that these men who are always ready become dangerous for society. So there have been all of the laws and restrictions that we put on sex and sexual behavior and mating, and all the contracts and all the commitments and all of the limitations we put on males are precisely created for that reason. Because the male of the human species can be so overpowering and so overdriven by his sexuality that it is very dangerous. So we have all these laws and structures to contain men's sexuality precisely because it's such an out-of-control force. But the other side of it, the positive side of it, is look how successful we are at reproducing. I mean, look what a successful species we are, right? We are the most successful ever in history, and it seems like unless we screw up in a big way, we can continue to be that way.
So let's recap. Here we are, animals trying to get by, trying to run away from the lion. Therefore, we try to get a big head. We grow a big head, but it's too big for our mother's pelvis. We wind up killing our mother by being born. Mom can't let us pass through because our heads are too big. Mom dies. Mom figures it out. She says, hey, wait a minute. We can't go having babies at an early age. We're too small. We're too young. We don't have a mate to take care of us. We better figure this out. We're going to figure out how not to have sex too early, too fast, right? So we're going to think about it. We're going to learn to limit sex. The way we limit sex is we're going to actually turn off our estrus. We're going to turn off our signals. We're going to turn off our own desire. We won't be hot. We won't be ready. We're now going to make deals with the male. Now, the very interesting thing is we're going to see if we could pick the right male, if he's strong enough to take care of us, if he could give us the right food, if he could bring us things. Now let's talk about iron. Let's go back in time and talk about women and meat.
Yes. One more thing I want to say, though, is that it seems so complicated, Armand, that one would ask, well, why would nature play such a trick on humans? Why not keep things simple like they are between other, in the couples of other primates, etc.? Because the human baby is so precious. It is the most evolved creature in the universe. So the difficulties and the advantages that humans have obtained through all this struggle have been clearly that the creature that has emerged out of the struggle is this fantastic animal with the brain that is the most complex and delicately perfect structure in the universe. So having said that, it was worth it. That's my opinion.
And this is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti.
Let's go to the iron, yes.
Roberta Maria Atti, we're on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial in New York City. If you're listening to us on the web, as well you may be, you're listening, maybe hearing us in Italy or in Scandinavia. It's a kind of remarkable show because of WBAI and the programs that they present. Mm-hmm. And only this kind of program. Okay, Roberta.
Let's talk about
women
iron.
And meat.
Okay. So now we have a female that says, no, I'm not ready for sex. And she, however, wants her male to be ready all the time. Because when she's ready, she doesn't want to have to go look for him. She wants him to be ready when she is. In order to do that, she hides her estrus. But to compensate for that, she makes herself look like she's always in estrus, meaning that the human female is the most sexually, visually, is the most sexually, what's the right word, Armand? She's showing just the shape of her body, the way she walks, the way she looks at the male. It's the most sexual of all animals because she wants him to think that she could always be fertile. Her investment in the reproductive game is such that not only could she lose her life through the childbirth, as we talked about, but also, I guess, maybe in exchange for having the power to say no, nature required that the female gave even more in the game of reproduction. And what she gives is blood, iron. Iron is the molecule that is necessary for oxygen to be transported. Oxygen, the brain in a human body consumes 2/3 of the available oxygen. When the woman is pregnant, the brain of the baby growing inside her consumes equal amounts of iron almost as her own. Now you have loss of iron through the menses, through the menstruation. You have tremendous loss of iron through childbirth because at childbirth a woman always loses a lot of blood. The placenta itself is a sponge that contains a lot of blood, and when it comes out, the woman loses, I think, by the time a woman is done with her reproductive years, she has lost gallons of blood.
Even lactation, isn't it?
And I was going to get to that. Even lactation, which lasts, naturally it should last
breastfeeding,
at least 2 years, you're losing a lot of iron there as well because milk is really blood made sweet for the baby's sweet tooth, I guess. So the woman is losing tremendous amount of this very valuable substance that the body cannot make. The body must ingest it through diet. And since she gives birth to a creature that is the most dependent in the animal kingdom, she needs to devote at least 5 years to each offspring, whereby she can't go out and get her own food and hunt. She can perhaps gather some plants and roots and berries close to home, but she can't. She doesn't have the time and energy to go out and hunt. So now what she says to her male is, yes, I'll risk my life to have your baby. I will put my life at stake for this. I will lose all this blood and all this iron, and I will become dependent on you for giving me the iron that allows me to survive myself and to allow this baby to grow and to develop a brain that's functional and to develop a body that's strong. So the female says to the male, I need you to go out and hunt. I need you to go out and bring me this iron that I need in order to have your child. So, okay, the males adapt, because what do the males want? I mean, Freud said, what do females want? And Dr. Schlein says, females want iron. What does the male want? The male wants sex. Remember, we talked about how the human brain developed in such a way that that's what it wants all the time. So the male says, okay, I want sex. She wants iron. I'm going to go out and hunt.
And iron is meat.
Iron is meat. So, well, you can get iron from plants, but it's not in a form that is nearly as easily absorbed.
She doesn't say, go out and get me some kale. No. She says, go out and get me some meat.
No, because in order to compensate for all the blood loss that a woman has to undergo through reproductive years, really, she cannot get enough iron.
So it's all about meat. Go get me meat. He wants meat. She wants meat.
Okay, so now the brain of the male that wants sex says, okay, I have to get meat. So now, in order to get the meat, I have to become a good hunter. The better hunter I am, the more I'm going to be able to bring home meat. But in order to be a good hunter, I need a hormone that is going to sharpen my senses, that is going to make me cold-blooded, ruthless, and merciless, that is going to allow me to be fearless, that is going to allow me not to feel pain and cold and discomfort.
So what do you think, my friends? Here we have this nice guy who just wants to be a mate. He wants to have sex. He's doing okay. And here all of a sudden he's being told, you know, he can't any longer, he can't read this signal. He's got to be able to go out there and go on the hunt. So what do you think he has to develop? What hormone do you think a man has to develop in order to bring home the bacon? Well, yep, you guessed it. The enemy of all hormones. The one that a man is the most criticized for having. The one that women say, get lower on that thing. Testosterone, right? Mm.
Testosterone is the hormone that allows a male to be a strong hunter. The more testosterone a male has, the more aggressive he is, the more impervious to pain and discomfort, the more also his visual acuity becomes sharpened. A lot of the abilities that make a good hunter come from testosterone. Also, the ability to not feel empathy. You see, empathy is something that testosterone doesn't get along with. Testosterone does the opposite. It allows a man to be cruel and cold-blooded and domineering in order for him to be merciless. When he comes in face-to-face with that harmless, beautiful gazelle that looks at him with those eyes, and he's got that arrow shoot, he cannot feel empathy or compassion.
Because his wife wants meat.
Because his wife wants meat. So, his wife is his baby, more important than his wife. His wife is only a vehicle.
Right.
Because, you know, paternity, now if we get into paternity, we're going to find that humans are the most interested in their offspring.
Well, we're
going
to have
animals.
To hold that for another show.
For another time. But just to say, it's not just the wife that he cares about, it's the baby.
Especially. So, my friends, listen, before we start getting men to reduce their testosterone and call that pathological, and to talk about their sex drive and say that's pathological, and then to talk about, you know, how women should not be as fake with their hidden sexual stuff, and maybe they shouldn't wear as much makeup, we can now understand how this entire thing emerged.
Well, the thing that's interesting is that the very quality that females, human females, have helped shape in males, which is the quality of being good hunters, is what then they recriminate at home when the testosterone makes a male behave in the typical, stereotypical ways that women criticize the most. And truly, all of the if you look at all of the laws and all of the regulations of society and all of the constrictions and commitments, they're all there to prevent social damage and danger caused, brought on by testosterone behavior, related behavior, to the great majority. So testosterone is this really double-edged sword that on one hand allows the human species to be the most successful on the planet, but on the other also makes them the most cruel and dangerous to the planet and to themselves and to one another. So there's something to be said for being aware that these are the dynamics that shaped our evolution, because I think if we understand that this is what happened, well, I'll leave the rest to you, Armand. What can we do about it?
Well, we could not so feel so stupid.
I mean, it's for really, one thing.
For one thing, if you kind of think about where we've come, and you think about this bottleneck, and you think about how we got through this big head, small pelvis thing, you know, you kind of understand that we almost didn't make it, friends. And that which we have now, which we're trying to adapt again, you know, now we've got cesareans, you know, now we've got different things, but it's going to take time.
But the question that comes up in my mind, Armand, is not so much how do we control testosterone? How do we limit it? How do we suppress it? Because, frankly, when you look at what happens to men when you try to do away with testosterone, is not what we want either, right?
You know,
we don't want we don't want males that are testosterone less. But isn't there, and this is a question I put out to the universe, isn't there a way to use testosterone in a way that is, you know, not so dangerous and destructive, and to appreciate it for what it does?
It's very good furniture polish, by the way. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Yes, testosterone is very good.
Where do you get it? I can't find it.
you know, Roberta,
you must buy it in New Jersey.
Maybe there's a, I could smell it there all the time. Maybe there's a way, eventually, you know, maybe what eventually happens to us is we go back. Maybe what happens is that the natural way begins to reemerge. Maybe it's no longer necessary for women to hide their estrus. Maybe it's no longer necessary for men to be pansexual. You know, maybe the eventual evolution will be that we will be beyond this hidden sexuality and pansexuality.
Maybe we'll come up with a way to alter the genome so that we all become hermaphrodites, and then there's no longer need for romantic dates. You just have a date with yourself, and you're all set.
There's a lot more. There's a lot more about this that we would love to present to you, but unfortunately, my friends, we have run out of time.
Well,
but I'll tell you,
we could present more in the future. There's so much to be said.
We will, and. And the next time we're together, we will bring you even more of this. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti, here with you on WBAI. If you wanted a copy of today's program to try to explain yourself to your mate as to either why you don't want to have sex or why you want to have sex too often, we want a copy of this, you can call 212-757-4488. That's 212-757-4488. There's also Roberta, you know, it's real interesting, the gathering of women that you do. Where is that thing taking place?
Well, I don't do it, but it's a very interesting thing. It happens in Virginia, and it's Twin Oaks Community, twinoaks.com. And it's a wonderful thing.
It's
gathering at twinoaks.com.
Okay. And you could also reach Roberta at robertaforhealth@aol.com. We've got to get going.
Roberta for Health with the number 4.
4 in the middle. Roberta for Health, armand@brainlink.com, all these addresses.
No, no. Roberta for Health at AOL.
At AOL.com.
Right. No.
Roberta for Health at AOL.com.
For Health at AOL.com. Yes, sorry. I'm confused.
Right. No wonder. Anyway, friends, be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. It's a little more, what do we do? We'll say goodbye to you and we'll leave a little of this for Michael. Here we go.
Every living thing will surely call.